Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
The Tennis Podcast.
The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. I am Catherine Whittaker, tennis broadcaster with Eurosport. I am joined by David Law, who has been commentating for BT Sport. And that is the reason that I am presenting this tennis podcast, because David looks like he might not last for the full duration of the recording before falling asleep. How are you doing, David?
I'm all right. I did have a bit of a sleep in the car on the way over here, so I don't really know where I am or what day it is. I'm also looking around me at the moment because you sent me a photo about half an hour ago of a Rosie the dog lookalike. And after hearing Rosie's bark last week, I'm a bit twitchy, to be honest. I really thought about not coming. But you then sent me a photo showing me that this dog is no longer here. So anyway, I think we're all right. How is Rosie, by the way?
She's great. Well, I see on the agenda that you've composed for this podcast, number one on that agenda is Rosie update. She's fine. I feel like she's getting a bit of a bad reputation. She is the most delightful dog. She is very much a proverbial bark worse than bite. David's shaking his head. He doesn't like it. As a matter of urgency, I should explain our surroundings, because they're going to make themselves very clear any moment now by some sort of announcement over the tannoy, because we're at Waterloo Station in London, at Carluccio's to be precise. Other high street restaurant chains owned by well-loved Italian chefs are available. We're at Carluccio's in Waterloo Station. There will be announcements intermittently for imminently departing trains, one of which I will be on at some point in the next hour or so. David will be hot-footing it back to Stratford for more BT Sport commentary on Beijing this week, which brings us on to, well, our first topic of discussion after Rosie update, which I think we've covered. David, do you feel like we've covered that?
Yeah, I think we're okay with that. I would say, just to reassure everybody, when I say I fell asleep in the car, I wasn't driving the car, I was a passenger in it. But anyway, that's all fine.
I should point out that this is quite momentous. David, unlike myself, is not a napper. I mean, napping is probably what I do best in life, but David is not a napper. This is unusual behaviour. I'm concerned we might not make it through this podcast, so I'm going to press on very quickly. Second on the agenda, Wuhan review, a tournament that was won in barnstorming style by Petra Kvitova. What a statement from her.
Or as my son said, the kicking ka player, who he's decided he is his favourite in the tennis world. He's four, everybody. I mean, my goodness, wasn't she good? You don't see Petra Kvitova play like that often. But when she does, it is so
unplayable.
It's unplayable. I saw a couple of people, including colleague of ours, Piers Newbury from the BBC Sport website. He tweeted that he was laughing out loud at some of the returns she was hitting, and it got me thinking. You know, that there are certain players out there, when they hit their peak form, that your response isn't just to watch and applaud or gasp; it's to laugh. And you know, I asked on Twitter for suggestions of players who make you feel like that. I'll tell you a couple of those in a minute. But that's what Petra Kvitova did. I mean, she was beating people with scorelines that were almost offensive.
Yeah, poor Dominika Sobolkova in the final. I mean, she wasn't in the match, was she?
No, I mean, it was 6-1, 6-1, and I think she... I read she won 1 point in the first four games, and it's not like she was playing badly. She got to the final, for goodness sake. She was in form. She's scrapping. You know what Dominika Sabalenka's like? She scraps for every single point in every single match, and she is trying to get to Singapore, and yet she was blitzed aside as though she was nothing.
That description actually reminds me of a very similar assessment given by lots of people after the last Wimbledon that Kvitova won, beating Bouchard in the final. Of course, all the attention was on Bouchard, her reaching her first Grand Slam final, and the assessment afterwards trying to assess how she had played, and it was just, well, it was fine. She just wasn't in the match because Kvitova was... how Kvitova can be every now and then, which is frankly unplayable.
Yeah, and it's interesting to try to get to the bottom or assess why that is. Why does she do this every so often and then for long, long periods of time gets nowhere near that sort of level? I mean,
because she's a human being, I think. She's not a robot. She's just completely human.
But Catherine, they're all human beings. None of them are robots. I know
some of them show fewer signs of it than others.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but look, Roger Federer, in his pomp, would make us react a bit like we're reacting to Kvitova now on a regular basis. There are other players that do it far more often.
Yes, and they're utterly extraordinary. That isn't the norm. That's unusual. I think the fact that it's a shame that Kvitova is unable to do it as frequently, but I can completely relate to why she's not able to produce that week in, week out.
Yeah, no, I can see what you mean. It's interesting. Mike Tomlinson on Twitter, # players that make you laugh when playing well. Vavrinka, he's probably the most similar, I would say, on the men's side in terms of that ability to just play silly tennis. You're thinking you can't hit the winners off that perfectly good serve or decent deep return, and yet he's just stepping around them and just saying, just get out of here.
I rewatched the US Open final on TV because I watched it without commentary at the time. I watched it live in the stadium, so I watched the Eurosport coverage with the commentary and everything just because I'm such a nerd. And I was watching Djokovic's reaction sort of in that third set, particularly his reactions to how Vavrinka was playing, and he just, I mean, he was almost laughing at points because he, you know, his reaction was, well, what am I supposed to do about this? I'm the best player in the world. That I shouldn't be in this situation. How absurd that I'm in this situation.
Yeah, by the way, whose commentary were you listening to again?
Eurosports.
Not mine.
Well, you weren't on the telly, David. You weren't on the telly.
Okay. I'll try to get over that. I fully agree with you. Interesting on Kvitova, something that really struck me that she said after victory was, I think I probably just need to accept that I'm never going to be consistent. I'm never going to be somebody who can do this week in, week out. But I will have days when it happens, and they're great. But the other thing that struck me is, you know, when a year and a half ago, when she signed up a physical trainer and she was looking really trim and sort of more athletic and physically strong than I'd ever seen her look in terms of just her sheer physical off-court training, and then she had a period of time out of the game, and Anne Kyotovong said on commentary during the final, she said, not everybody is built to train like that, and some people are better off spending more time on the match court and just playing tennis and just enjoying it and not driving themselves into the ground. Some players, like Andy Murray, has worked out, I have to put myself through this Spartan-like training regime in order to be at the best and get the best out of myself. Not everybody's built like that.
I think that's really interesting. There's a, you know, when Vavrinka had his run in New York and obviously won the tournament, there was a lot of attention on what Magnus Norman said about him and his natural fitness, and that's something that we perhaps haven't appreciated. He's a completely different physical specimen to Andy Murray, to Novak Djokovic, who are completely different physical specimens to one another. In fact, you've probably got the greatest contrast in terms of players at the top in the men's game in terms of their physicality. You know, Roger Federer compared to Rafael Nadal, just two completely different beasts. People are fit in different ways, I think, and different styles of training suit them differently. There is not a one-size-fits-all approach. I think that's a really, really interesting point to make. Kvitova now has an outside chance, I believe, of qualifying for Singapore. We'll come on to that race in more detail because it's complicated. There are a lot of permutations. But first, next on my agenda, David, which I keep referring back to, is Wuhan crowds. We can't avoid it, can we? Because you used the word awkward when we were talking about it just before we started recording. I watched the final yesterday and I was pleasantly surprised at the crowds. They were really decent, or this morning, whenever it was, really very decent. But earlier in the week, they were not decent. There's no getting around it, are there? They were not decent crowds earlier in the week. And it's a big old stadium to only have a couple of hundred people in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 15,000-seat stadium. It is spectacular. It is gorgeous what they've put together in Wuhan. And let's not forget, this event is only three editions old. It is a brand new event. Plus, it was brought to Wuhan partly off the back of Lina's success, and then she retired basically at the same time as the tournament started. So that was a blow to it. But what I really wanted to... You know, I don't want to come across as being negative about the place, because I think it's fantastic what they've built there in terms of infrastructure and the enthusiasm and the professionalism of the event, because it clearly is there. They have moved mountains to try to make that tournament as good as it can be, and they responded to me on Twitter when I said that it's why are the crowds so small inside this stadium? You know, is it a general apathy towards sport or tennis within the country, or certainly within the city? I don't know. And the Wuhan Tennis Tournament Twitter feed responded and said, look, we have crowds that are rising based on last year, and we are in it for the long term. And I have huge respect for that. I mean, it takes time for crowds and enthusiasm to grow. I did a little bit of research, at least by talking to a couple of people who I know have covered the event out there and covered tennis in China for a long time, and to try to get a sense for something that I might be missing, because I haven't covered tennis in China. And the gist of it was, look, this is a sport that really wasn't on the radar at all a number of years ago, and it's about introducing it to people and making them aware that it exists, that it's great, that it's an option, that it's better than doing something else with your money. With there's also the element of the sheer cost of going to these tennis tournaments, given the disposable income available, and how busy people are with their general working life. And let's be honest, I was talking about a shot on TV of a stadium in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday. So, you know, these are all mitigating circumstances to why that stadium looked so empty. It's just, when you do see it, it's a horrible look for tennis, because it feels wrong. You've got world-class tennis players, and you've got a massive stadium, and you've got hardly anybody in it. It's a shame. But you're right, the final couple of days, certainly the final, was a good atmosphere. I've just done the first day of our coverage. I think it's day two of Beijing on BT Sport. And it was a good atmosphere again. It was a much better atmosphere. Now, that's obviously a tournament with more than a decade of history, so that has had time to build as well. The capital of China. And, you know, they have had good crowds in the past. So I felt we needed to discuss it, but I'm hopeful that it's definitely going in the right direction.
Essentially, I think supply has come before demand, and the hope is, and the indications from Beijing, the more established tournament, and Shanghai, I think, as well, is that demand will follow. But essentially, I mean, understandably, I think tennis got very, very excited about the market possibilities of China and Asia. And tennis isn't alone in that. I mean, the world has been very excited over the last 10, 15 years about the financial possibilities of, it's horrible terminology, but exploiting that market. And so I think started exploiting that market before the demand existed. But I certainly think the indications are that demand is very much growing. I think from what I can get, I covered a Champions Tour event in Chengdu for a number of years, the same venue that is now hosting the men's event in Chengdu, which is just finished. The crowds were not good. They were very much not good. There were lots of things stacked against the tournament. The weather was horrendous. Dreadful, dreadful smog, all those sorts of things. And they hadn't had a long time to market it. However, there was obviously lots of talk about the crowds being poor. And the locals just said, spectator sport is a very, very new thing here. It's not deeply entrenched in the psyche. You know, in this country, people have been going out on a Saturday to watch football every week for the last 150 years. That's not the case in China. It's going to take a long time to build up that culture, but that doesn't mean that won't be the case. And it's certainly, I think the rate of development is fast.
Well, absolutely right. And the resources are there. The sheer number of people are there in terms of tapping into hopefully into a demographic that eventually really wakes up and realizes how good tennis is. And hopefully there's a way that once the interest is peaked, that it'll be made possible for more people to go and they'll want to go. But I certainly enjoyed commentating on it today in Beijing, and hopefully that'll come across over the next week that crowds in Beijing are better.
Absolutely, very well said. Yeah, the signs are good for Beijing this coming week. Now, I'm going to stop obfuscating and start talking about the Road to Singapore leaderboard, which is ever so complicated. This is a particularly onerous task to have to talk you through this. It's complicated in a great way. It's incredibly exciting. By contrast to the men's race for the O2, which we'll come on to later. But David's nodding and indicating, let me talk about it, because I understand it brilliantly. So I'm just going to hand the microphone over to David. He's got the, you know, every single permutation, do you, David?
No, I don't know every single permutation, but what I have had to do is obviously study it a fair bit for commentary. I mean, we obviously, from a British television station point of view, are looking at the very outskirts of the top eight and whether Joe Konta, a British player, might be able to squeeze into that top eight.
It's looking unlikely, isn't it? It's not looking good for Nigel Sears' prediction, which he relayed last week.
As much as anything, talking to Nigel today, I know that he feels that the way she has applied herself this year, he feels she deserves to be there. Now, you could say that about any player, couldn't you? But I know what he means. It's rare that you see a substandard performance from Joe Konta in 2016. But the way it is at the moment, in eighth position is Madison Keys, and some 350 points behind her is Jo Konta in 11th position. Now, the upshot is, I think she needs to get to the semi-finals to realistically stand any chance. That would give her 390 points, and she needs...
He's got numbers. He's got numbers as well. Wow.
The thing is, the early two or three rounds in these tournaments, you don't get a huge amount for. You get 60 points and then another 60 points. When you get to the semis, you get 350. If you get to the final, you get 650. 390 and then 650. If you win it, you get 1,000. So you're suddenly doubling your points each time, which makes a massive difference in terms of those standings.
And just to make it all uber exciting, Kuznetsova, Konta, Kvitova, no, Muguruza, Keys, Kuznetsova, Kvitova have all been drawn in the same quarter.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be some head-to-head matches in the third round and quarterfinals, which will have a direct bearing on who ends up going. But Simona Halep will qualify very shortly. Agnieszka Radwanska is on the brink. Muguruza isn't far away. These are players that will all qualify. I think the only ones that are really vulnerable in the top eight are Sibulkova in seventh position, and then in eighth position, Madison Keys. Those are the ones that could still be caught. Really.
The Venus Williams?
Well, she's down in, I think, 12th position. She's now behind Jo Konta, some way adrift. In fact, no, 13th now, because Kvitova has leapfrogged her. If Kvitova were to win and just go and do Peak Petra and win Beijing, she will get there. She will get 1,000 points. It'll put her ahead of everybody else in that little cluster, and she will qualify. But I think she needs to reach the final.
I mean, potential round of 16 matchups in Beijing. It's mouthwatering. Pliskova, Konta, Sibulkova, Suarez, Navarro. But Suarez, Navarro is already out.
Third round would be Pliskova against Konta. That's how early on we're seeing those players meeting. And then, I mean, just to give you an idea of what Konta's up against here, third round Pliskova, quarterfinal Halep, just to get to the semis. My little theory is that Pliskova only has to get to the third round to qualify for the tour finals. I think that could well take an edge off certain players if they've already qualified. It's just human nature. I've seen it before. I'm perhaps grasping at straws from a British perspective. Look, we try to be objective, but from a specifically British perspective, we are interested in how Konta goes. And today, she won 6-1, 6-1 against Anastasia Sevastova, who defeated her at the US Open. And Sevastova wasn't very good today, but Konta was relentless. And she looks like she's well capable of having a deep run. I mean, she may run into somebody playing like Kvitova did, but I have a feeling Konta's going to have a deep run in Beijing.
Okay. Deep run is, in terms of the road to Singapore, pretty vague, David. Who's going to do it? Who isn't? Is it going to be a deep enough run is essentially what I mean.
No, I think she's going to just miss out. I think she might make the semis. I think she might make the semis and still just miss out.
Okay, so I'm going to assume that all the top six is set in stone and we've got two places up for grabs. That's what I'm going to assume. Everyone up to Muguruza, we're saying, is okay. Next up, we have Sibulkova. In or out?
In.
Suarez Navarro. Well, she's lost already. Can she still do? Does she need everybody to lose, pretty much?
Yeah, and she needs to enter something else like Moscow or one of the other tournaments and get points there. I don't think she's going to make it.
Madison Keys.
Yeah, I think she'll make it.
So you're saying Jo Konta out?
Here's what I think. I think Sibulkova and Keys are in the box seats, and I think Kuznetsova plays Keys, I believe, in the early rounds. It'll all depend on who wins that, really.
Oh, that'd be good, wouldn't it? Playing off, essentially, that would be a great match.
Yeah, but there is still a question mark over Serena and whether she will actually play. She's missing Beijing. If she doesn't make it, if she doesn't play Singapore, then I think as things stand, Konta will go as an alternate. That is my feeling on it.
Do you think Serena will play? We obviously talked about this last week. Do we know any more than we did last week when we talked about whether or not she'd play?
No, I mean, her quotes after pulling out are that I've got a long-standing shoulder injury. She was actually quite explicit and said, I don't want to turn up at these tournaments anymore and take losses that I shouldn't be taking.
She said, I'm fed up with playing injured, didn't she? That's pretty telling.
Yeah, and she said, I want to get ready for Singapore. She was very explicit about that. Now, whether that's enough time to recover sufficiently to not feel as if she's playing injured, I have no idea. But that'll be, to me, that's certainly not assured that she will go.
Let's talk about Beijing from the men's point of view. Andy Murray is playing. He's there. Novak Djokovic is not there. He's pulled out due to his elbow injury, the same injury he says that caused him issues with the serve. Did he call it a micro injury? Was that his word? It's a new term. I mean, haven't we all got sort of a million micro injuries? I mean, I think, didn't Rafael Nadal once said the last time I played without any pain? You know, he's a walking micro injury. He's pulled out of Beijing. Andy Murray is going. What do we think about this? Do we, you know, there's all sorts of permutations regarding that number one ranking. You know, yes, it's still an enormous gap, but Andy Murray, surely every time this happens, every time he has an opportunity to steal a march, he's got to be wide-eyed about it, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have the same degree of points as the women's event has, because that's got 1,000 points for the winner, whereas the men's has only got 500. But it is another opportunity for Andy Murray to get points on the board and continue that move towards number one, which obviously we know he wants and that he hopes he'll eventually get. Djokovic, I find particularly interesting. He gave some quotes over the last couple of days about how effectively he wants to start taking pressure off himself and stop worrying about number one and stop worrying about winning Grand Slams and just play a little bit more rather than concerning himself with the repercussions of doing so.
He said, I want to worry about numbers less and records less. You know, I think after he won that French Open, which how could you not be obsessed with getting that in the position that he was in, and you know everything that had happened the year before him, getting so close several times, but I'm sure the Wawrinka one was particularly heartbreaking. It seems like after that, I mean, lots of things have happened, lots of speculation about what's happened has happened, but it sounds like he just wants to obsess about it all less and just get back to hitting forehands and backhands.
Yeah, and I can understand that. I think it's pretty stressful. I remember seeing Pete Sampras right at the end, not at the end of his career, but certainly when he was trying to finish world number one for a sixth year in a row. I remember when I was an ATP communications manager back in 1998, and he was going for that record. It had never been done before. It's still never been done since. Nobody has ever matched. That's one record he's got all to himself. And he was so miserable that week as he was trying to seal it, and I remember I was taking him to press conferences, and he looked like he would rather be anywhere else, and he was admitting it. He was saying, I just, you know, you could see it written all over his face, how stressful and how fatigued he felt, and how he clearly just wanted a simpler life, but he got to get this first.
Because there'll always be another record to go for, right? Once you get one, you know, oh, you've beaten Roy Emerson. You're up to whatever it is in the all-time list. Okay, so now go one place higher. Okay, you've got the calendar year Grand Slam. No, you've got the career Grand Slam. Okay, but go for the calendar year Grand Slam or the calendar year Golden Slam. There'll always be another record to go for. At some point, you've got to say, okay, I'm happy with that. I'm going to let myself enjoy it. I'd love more. That'd be great. But you've just got to say, I've achieved that record, and that's great, and that's enough.
It's like boxers with comebacks. You know, you've got to know when to call it a day. And one thing that Sampras has said in recent years since then is, you know, inevitably people say, you know, you worked all these years to amass all these records, and within a couple of years, Federer came along and just picked them all off one by one. And you could argue that that's now happening with two other players, Nadal and Djokovic. And yet, if you wanted to be really uncharitable as Sampras or irritated by it, you could be. There is reason enough there to be thinking it's just not fair. But he actually has said on a number of occasions, whether he means this or not, I take him at face value. He said, look, I'm happy with my career. I did what I did. I'm happy with it. And good luck to these guys. If they can beat that, fair play. You can't argue with that. And you've got to find peace with your own achievements in life. Sounds quite philosophical, but I genuinely believe that. And Djokovic is an interesting one, because he's still on that journey, and he is still, it's reachable for him. That's the interesting thing for me, is that what's he on, 12 slams? It's reachable that he could get up to 17. It suddenly does, though, feel quite a long way away. Whereas a year ago or 6 months ago, it felt really, really close. Now, we tend to be very reactive on this podcast in the tennis world.
But it's not just us, is it? I'm suddenly, hearing you say that, I'm suddenly remembering what Goran told you at the Australian Open this year after Djokovic had won it. He sort of said in a slightly casual way, well, which one, you know, who's going to stop him getting to beating Federer's record? Which Grand Slams isn't he going to win? As if just because he's playing this brilliantly now, and he's only 29 years old, or 28 as he was at the time, you know, who's going to stop him? And it's just not that simple, is it?
No, it's not. And we've had this conversation in the past. Remember when we put into one of the podcasts a few months back the interview I did, sorry, name dropping again, but the interview I did with Federer in 2010 when he was on 16 slams, and I said, how many more do you want? Would you take three more in 5 years? And he said no, and he's won one more in 6 years. And it shows it's not that easy. Nadal, when he got to 14 and he won the US Open and all this, we all thought this guy's going to catch Federer. He's going to win. He wins the French Open every year, doesn't he? Well, he hasn't won it the last 2 years. And now it's the same with Djokovic.
Despite David Law predicting that he will.
All right. Hey, I predicted Djokovic this year, didn't I? I did. I was the one.
So did I, didn't I?
All right, well,
I think we all did, yeah.
Everybody, the whole world predicted it, and here we are showing off about it. But, no, I think it is a trap that is all too easy to fall into, to just assume that because it's happening now, it'll continue to happen. It's fascinating finding out, though, isn't it? But, you know, Djokovic is definitely reassessing, because those micro-injuries that he refers to, there's been quite a handful of them lately, and that hasn't been the case in the past.
Yeah, I really like that expression. I really like it. I think it might be one of those expressions like super coach, which just gets, you know, it'll be common currency in tennis lingo by this time next year. We're going to have a little chat about the ATP race to the O2, but first of all, just to bring you up to date with a couple of things that have happened in the past week on the ATP World Tour. Thomas Burdick, who's doing his very best to make up for lost time and try and insert himself into the O2 conversation. He's won the title in Shenzhen this week, beat Richard Gasquet in the final, and Karen Khachanov has won his maiden ATP World Tour title in Chengdu. It's the second hashtag next gen title winning moment in 2 weeks. The ATP website is very excited about that. There's hashtag next gen everywhere. How good is Karen Khachanov, David?
Well, you know that he's got potential as well, because Brad Gilbert, he's beside himself as well.
What's his nickname?
Do you know, there was actually somebody said to him, what nickname have you got for Karen Khachanov? I don't even know if I'm pronouncing the guy's name correctly here.
Well, if we're pronouncing it wrong, we're pronouncing it wrong in the same way, which is always crucial, I feel.
Yeah, I even read that Brad was saying that you don't even pronounce the K on the surname, so maybe it's Karen Khachanov. I don't know. You know, this...
When did Brad Gilbert become the Russian language authority?
When he started calling Bernard Tomic Weekend at Bernie's, probably. Look, I'm not dissing Brad. I mean, they're entertaining, aren't they, these nicknames? But he hadn't come up with anything yet. And I also feel as though I'm always quite amused when a new player comes along and we don't really know how to pronounce his name or her name. And then a few years later, it just becomes so much of common parlance that we look back and cringe at ourselves. I do it now about, if I were to watch coverage of Moscow last year and when we were commentating on BT Sport, and my butchering of Kasatkina, which I could not say correctly.
What were you saying?
A combination of about four different things, none of which were right.
My favourite Arsenal, I listened to two Arsenal podcasts. No one can agree on how to pronounce Santi Cazorla's name, so it's fine.
No, there's a th in it, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I've probably just got it wrong. Just interestingly, tweeted by the ATP, there have been 9 first-time winners on the ATP World Tour this year. That's the most since 2011 when there are 10. There could yet be another one, so it's the most at the moment since 2011. So there's definitely something in this hashtag next gen thing, isn't there?
There's a gathering group. I mean, to be fair, they've picked enough players to stick hashtag next gen next to, which you can't blame them, can you, really?
There is an official formula for it. I think it's under 21 or 21 and under and inside the top 200. There's an official formula.
Well, fair enough, you know. And actually, I like the group that is coming along, and the fact that they're all winning titles in fairly close proximity, their first titles, and it's exciting to see them take on the sort of what we thought of as the next gen of Raonic and Nishikori and Dimitrov and people like that who...
Team
who's kind of bridges the two, and then obviously the established order, and then the old fellas like Federer and Nadal. I mean, Nadal against Pui, as you keep telling me to call him, being the perfect example. So, I mean, I'm glasses half full kind of person anyway, but I like...
No, David, no. You do surprise me.
Well, unless Rose is about...
It's irony.
Unless Rose is around and then I just hide in the corner. I mean, crikey. What do you feed that dog on? Raw meat or what?
If you could only meet her, David, you would feel so silly. She is just a delight.
No intention of meeting her ever.
She does high five on demand. What's not to like?
Well, we definitely need to get that on video.
So we are going to talk about the race to the O2. So we've got Djokovic, Murray, Wawrinka are the only three that have officially qualified. But it's not that much of a race, is it? There's a little bit more of a way to go. So there are a few more things that could shake out. There's 2 1,000 events still to come. So it is mathematically possible that Burdick, Cilic and Goffin, who are in 9th, 10th and 11th, could get there. But it is looking unlikely, isn't it? I saw a poster yesterday. I can't remember. I was driving along somewhere. I think I was on the Lower Richmond Road in Putney. And I saw a poster, huge poster, for the ATP World Tour Finals. And it had all 8 players on it. Usually at this time of year, you'd sort of, you know, they make mock up a poster with 5 of them on it because the other 3 are still TBC. But Monfils was there, Thiem was there, Nadal was there. All 8 players were there, and it does look very much like we do know the 8 that are going to be there, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And to just run down them, there's at the top, obviously, Djokovic, Murray, Wawrinka, Raonic, Nishikori, Monfils, Thiem and Nadal in those positions just at the moment. But Burdick is just down beneath them, and then Marin Cilic. But... I mean, if one of those two did what Kvitova did and won Shanghai or won Paris, then they'll be part of that conversation too. But this has been the theme for certainly last year. I think there was a bit of a race the year before, wasn't there, when Murray was trying to get there and he was playing all those events to make sure he did. But in this last 2 years, this year and last year, it's been drama-free, really. There has been no real race because the top 8 have separated themselves.
Very, very interesting. I mean, it's going to be a huge motivator for Burdick, Cilic. I'm putting Goffin in there because it's mathematically possible, but hugely unlikely, I would say, that Goffin, he would probably have to win a Masters, win one of Shanghai or Paris, and have pretty good results at the other one. So, I'm putting him mathematically in the conversation. It's a huge motivator for them. It's interesting, Rafael Nadal is at number 8 at the moment. He is... we think pretty secure of qualifying. I've always found it interesting, particularly over the last year or so, but I think it's already been the case, he's obsessed with the race, isn't it? He's obsessed with qualifying for the O2 in a way that the others, I mean, they care about it and it matters to them, but in a way that you'd perhaps not expect a 14-time Grand Slam champion to be as obsessed with just making sure he's in the world's top 8 at the end of the year. I always find that interesting.
And yet, to be honest, it goes with his personality. I think he's somebody who is very ordered and he likes to have a clear indicator of where he is in life, whether it's the bottles and all the rest of it. And I can imagine him looking at that and thinking, well, that's how my year's going, you know, and probably feels quite comfortable with that.
Well, that's exactly what he says, because the indicators of his being... obsessed. I remember several times that I particularly have one incident in a press conference in Madrid, you know, where he was being fired questions about, oh, you're not having a great year, you know, not won a title, etc. And he said, oh, well, I'm doing all right in the race. I'm probably going to qualify for London. Everyone just thought, oh, that's how you're thinking.
I mean, you know, who's to argue with how he views his career? I tell you what, looking at that list, the names Monfils and Thiem really stick out to me, isn't it?
Exciting,
nice?
Isn't it?
Yeah, the thought of Monfils being in that group, I mean, fair play to him. I mean, I do feel he let himself down in that semi-final at the US Open, regardless of what he says. That's just my personal opinion. I think it's a shame. I'm sure he'll do better next time when he's in that position. But I love having him in that group. I mean, you can only imagine the sort of excitement that he might bring to that tournament. And a team, I know we question, and I would continue to question the sense of playing as much as he's playing.
Yeah, he might not be able to get out of bed come November.
But he does still keep doing so. And I also, just to cut him a bit of slack, I remember the first year Federer qualified for it. And I remember what he was like and how he was counting the points and how he was working it out and how stressed he was trying to just win that one last match in Paris to make sure he got there, and how glowing he was, glowing with pride when he managed to make it in 2002.
Well, it's a big deal. It is. Well, that's great, and I hope that team feels the same about it.
2001, I think, actually, it was. But I remember it was my last year. I can't remember what I was doing there, but I was in Paris-Bercy.
Just hanging out.
Yeah, I remember interviewing him. Sorry, name drop again. We should have a name drop klaxon, shouldn't we? A big, loud klaxon every time I drop a name. And Federer, yeah, he was absolutely delighted. So I can... Maybe that is the motivation. Maybe he just wants to make sure he gets there.
It's still a bit of a way away. We'll have plenty more conversation about that in tennis podcasts to come. Pole vault still remains to be done on this podcast. But just before then, we have three questions from listeners via Twitter. David, you're going to answer them very, very quickly. I've picked the best three from a slightly spurious selection. First of all, Khachanov or Kyrgios, who's having the better career? One word answers, please, David.
Draw.
Oh God!
Because the thing is, they're in different stages, aren't they? Khachanov is an unbelievable right.
Yeah, he's having the better career. If you had to put your money on one of them now, who are you going on?
Kyrgios.
Okay, easy. No ad at juice suggestions. Something which Reem Abdelil did an interview with Steve Simon this week, and he talked about how he wants to shorten the women's game, introduce more shorter formats of the women's game. Mentioned no ad juice. Good or bad, David? Good or bad?
Bad.
And then we have realistically, I should credit who's sending both of those questions were from Susie. This is from Bob's Nev. Realistically, do you think that Andy, presumably Murray, has a chance of claiming the number one spot, or will Djoko win Shanghai, Paris and the World Tour finals again?
I don't think he'll win all of them this year. I don't think Andy Murray will get to number one in the world this year, but I think he will next year.
Punchy. See, when you're pressed, David, I can get you off that fence. That is it for this segment of the Tennis Podcast. Pole Vault is coming up. That will be presented by David Law, because I refuse to have anything to do with it. So if you want to fast forward through that section, you can.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right then, we've got rid of Catherine Whittaker, so we can get on with pole vault, everybody. I know you've been waiting for that, and probably a lot of you just fast-forwarded the rest of that nonsense to get to this bit 42 minutes in. But anyway, my question to you on Twitter, at Tennis Podcast, peak Petra Kvitova, while she was destroying Simona Halep, I asked, peak Petra versus peak Serena, who wins? And in your votes, you told me 36% would go for Petra Kvitova at her peak. 64% would still go for Serena Williams. Catherine Whittaker is not looking very happy.
Well, she's got a 5-1 head-to-head against her. I mean...
Yeah, but that might not have been peak Petra ever.
Oh, yeah. Serena, obviously.
Catherine Whittaker there, here on the Tennis Podcast. I also asked you in pole vault, assuming the top seven qualify, who will take that eighth spot in the race to Singapore? I think I asked that about 4 or 5 hours ago, as I speak to you right now. So all those standings we told you about were still valid. Now, 56% of you said that Madison Keys will make it. She's currently in that eighth spot, so most of you are backing her. 4% said Suarez Navarro. Agree with you totally. 11% went with Kuznetsova, who is marginally ahead in points than Joe Konta in number 11, and there's 20 points between them. But 29% of you reckon that Joe Konta will make it. Quite a few people as an outsider, although we couldn't include her in pole vault because there wasn't five options to go with, but quite a few people replied with Kvitova. What do you think, Catherine? Who is going to make... Let's assume that all the other seven that are currently in there make it. Who is going to be the eighth?
Hang on. Remind me what Kvitova is going to need to do in Beijing this week in order to do it.
She's going to need to at least make the final and get 600-odd points. That would get her up to just on the heels of Keys as things stand. But Keys might obviously make some more progress. So realistically, she's got to win it.
It's really not in her hands, basically. Even if she wins it, though.
If she won it, I mean, the chances are she's in. She will be in if she wins it, I think.
Do you know what? She certainly could win it. I mean, talk about a role. I mean... She didn't expend too much energy winning in Wuhan last week, so I don't see that being an issue. My goodness me, that would be exciting. Yeah, go on then. I'll go for that. I'll take that.
Kvitova, says Catherine Whittaker here on Pole Vault. Now, one other question I asked you, the final pole vault of the week, is Caroline Wozniacki against Sam Stosur earlier on in the Wuhan tournament last week. I was watching this match, and it suddenly occurred to me, you know, here you've got Caroline Wozniacki, who's been world number one, and she's never won a slam. You've got Sam Stosur, who's won a slam and has never achieved anything like the same degree of ranking success and, I guess, consistency that Wozniacki has. But she's also reached another Grand Slam final as well, the French Open. Which of the two has had the better career? What do you think, Catherine Whittaker? I've asked the question on pole vault. What do you think?
I can't say who's had the better career. I know...
Whose would you have? If you could have one or other of their career, whose would you have?
I would take Sam Stosur's. I would have covet a Grand Slam above anything else. And I think most would. I certainly think, you know... Tim Henman was pretty unequivocal about that when we asked him last year. I would take Sam Stosur's career. Obviously, being the best tennis player in the world is a fantastic achievement, but I would have the slam.
54% of our loyal Tennis Podcast pole vault listeners say that they would also back Sam Stosur and rather have her career over the 46% who went for Wozniacki.
How did you word the question?
I worded it. Whose career would you rather have,
right,
Catherine Whittaker?
Whose is better? Whose would you personally rather have? Okay, that's fine. See, I've got no issue with pole vaults like that where people are just saying what they would like, you know.
I'm fine, so I've done 28 pole vaults in the last 2 weeks and one has finally got Catherine Whittaker's nod of approval. So I think we might be able to keep the category for another week, folks. And if we don't, I'll just run off with the microphone and do it in a corner while Catherine Whittaker just, you know, can do her own thing and hang out with Rosie. But the interesting conversation I had today on this subject, I actually brought it up on BT Sport and I just about managed to avoid saying pole vault.
He's only got so much material, he's having to reproduce it.
I'm having to spread it thinly. I had this conversation with Nigel Sears, top tour coach. And I said, what do you think? What would you as a coach covet more as an achievement out of a slam and a world number one ranking if you could only have one? He said he would go with the number one ranking. And I think that's probably quite an interesting coach's viewpoint. And he also pointed out she was number one in the world for 67 weeks in a row. I mean, that is a major achievement, particularly given that she didn't win a slam. But I always feel that there's just a bit of an asterisk next to her number one ranking as a result. And there's probably a lot of people that think that is very harsh, but that's kind of how I feel.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, it is harsh, but mention, you know, Caroline Wozniacki world number one to anyone and they'll, you know, scratch their head and say, oh yeah, wasn't that during sort of that period when, you know, Ivanovic got there and Dinara Safina got there and Jelena Jankovic got there and, oh, that was just a bit of a weird time in women's tennis, wasn't it? You know, that's rightly or wrongly what people think. And, you know, I'm not sure there can ever be an asterisk next to a Grand Slam title, you know.
Maybe. Should say that Ivanovic did both, of course, but I know exactly what you mean, and that the other players you mention are, I think they're also indicative of how great Serena Williams is on her day, that even when she was unable to string it all together and be consistently world number one, if she played in the tournament and played well, she won them.
Absolutely. Look, there's plenty of explanations for all of it. I'm not defending that viewpoint. I'm not saying any of those didn't deserve to be number one, or that, you know, I'm just saying that is a pretty widely held general view. And I'm not sure you can have that with a Grand Slam title. You know, there's no hiding. You can't. I mean, maybe, you know, Thomas Johansson, Australian Open, perhaps people could level that sort of, you know, there's the very odd one. But even then, I'd say, you know, he won that fair and square. That's, yeah, you can't argue with a Grand Slam title, I don't think, in the same way.
So, Catherine Whittaker has given the thumbs up to Pole Vault this week. Thank you all for listening here on the Tennis Podcast. Catherine's looking at me as if to say, that is not a thumbs up. One out of three selections is not sufficient to be a thumbs up. But anyway, Catherine, that's another Tennis Podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph. Do say hello to Rosie for me.
Well, no, I won't. You're not exactly her biggest fan. You have to meet her. She'll win you over within seconds, I promise.
Not worthy of Rosie.
No, you're not worthy of Rosie. She high-fives on demand. Come on. It's better than most humans.
It's pretty good, actually, isn't it? The Tennis Podcast's official mascot, Rosie the dog. We'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.